You're listening to the Paranormal UK Radio Network, the best in paranormal talk radio in the UK and around the world.
If you're fascinated by near-death or shared-death experiences and have ever said to yourself, I would love to encounter the same places as experiencers, this is why I've created both guided meditation albums and the extensive 5.5-day near-death experiential retreat. There's a link below that will give you all of the details, and I hope that you will find this a profound way to explore the non-physical universe and easily access expanded states of awareness. Welcome to the Afterlife Files, where we investigate near-death experiences, shared death experiences, and all things afterlife and how they affect you. Unlike podcasts that are just stories, we will give you a heads up on what to look for in our conversation. And then after the interview, stick around. We help you make sense of those accounts so that you can incorporate the insights into your life. I think that you'll find that once having your most profound questions answered, living life in the physical is filled with more peace and joy. This fascinating interview with Reverend Peter Panagor went way longer than normal. As a result, I've broken this podcast into two parts. This part, part number one, Peter describes ice climbing with his partner on a world-famous Lower Weeping Wall along the Icefields Parkway in Alberta, Canada. On their descent, they became trapped on the side of the mountain. As the sun set, he was overcome by exhaustion and hypothermia. He died on the side of that mountain. And in those minutes on the other side, he experienced hell, forgiveness, and unconditional love. Heaven was beautiful. You'll soon discover that Peter has a unique ability to put words to what others would call an ineffable experience. You'll soon discover that Peter has a unique ability to put words to what others would call an ineffable experience. Here's a couple of points to listen for. First, the author F. Scott Fitzgerald famously wrote, quote, "The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing ideas in mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function." I want you to note how many times Peter uses contrastic environments to describe his experience in the light. Here's several. Empty but full, profoundly dark, yet he has the ability to see almost to infinity. He was in energy, yet outside of it looking in. I hope you're inspired by this cognitive dissonance. If you can learn to trust both to be true, you'll go a long way in understanding the multidimensional nature of this space. Second, he does a nice section describing the role of God in the universe as panentheism. I plucked a helpful graphic from Google. It's great. It'll help. Third, his description of a life review is one of the best I have heard. Fourth, Peter tries to help us understand how in one moment you can understand the total love of the universe. He tries to give us a sense of that by this awesome rush of words. It adds emphasis way beyond the words in a visceral way. See if you can feel his words as well as hearing them. Here's our interview with Peter Panagor. Hello, everybody. We've got Peter Panagor with us today, and in preparation for this interview, I have to tell you, you already know the first part because this is one really chilly story that we're going to hear. So I got to get ready. Here we go.
Now, it's a little hard to hold a script with my mittens on, but it's cold in here. Excuse me. Here we go. The Reverend Peter Panagore was recruited to TV as the fifth minister of America's oldest religious broadcast. Peter's two-minute spot aired for 15 years just before the morning weather on News Center Maine. You can hear him talk like that, can't you? News Center Maine. On two NBC stations, reaching 80,000 viewers a day. Congratulations, that's pretty good. Previously, Peter served in New England as a United Church of Christ minister. His Audible bestseller, Heaven is Beautiful, has been optioned for a film. Second congratulations. His first book, 2 Minutes for God, is a non-denominational devotional drawn from his 1,700 TV stories. He's working on his third book, built around his talk, and provides mentoring to spiritual seekers worldwide. Welcome, Peter. Woohoo! Okay. So you heard in my introduction part A that Peter died while ice climbing. So that's, of course, the reason for this chilliness. So welcome again. And Peter, just start us off and tell us this great story.
So good to see you again here, Scott. Thank you for asking me.
In 1980,
I was an exchange student, a national student exchange, and I, during spring break, I got a climbing partner and a backcountry ski partner, and we went for a 10-day trip into British Columbia and Alberta. We spent 8 days snow caving on backcountry skis with backpacks to a place called Mount Assiniboine. And after that incredibly wonderful adventure, this is March, okay, and there's 10 feet of snow on the ground. So we went back to the Icefields Parkway, where we drove to Weeping Wall, a world-famous ice climb, where we climbed. I'd been a backpacker and a mountaineer, and not like Himalayan mountaineer, but United States mountains, and now Canadian mountains, winter camper, cross-country skier, national ski patrol, outdoor winter guy, rope climber, rock climber. Never climbed ice before, made a mistake in my equipment, tried to climb with an axe and a hammer. Those unequal parts made me exhausted rapidly. And so it slowed our climb. There were other teams on the rocks on the ice that day. We ended our climb that evening at sunset, which we were supposed to be down and leaving at that point. But we had just reached the top because of my slowness, and hypothermia came. There were three rappels. It was a night of terror. I'm not crying now because I went back in 2016 and I faced my trauma. I went back and with the help of some people, my place of terror became a return to humanity.
That's
2016. Nice. It was quite a change. So I don't tell my story with tears and brokenness anymore, but it was an incredibly terrifying night. It was so terrifying, and the drive for survival was so present that I accessed parts of what felt like, in retrospect, my brain, parts of my brain. And while I was experiencing it, I dug way down deep into like the what I thought of the mammalian, the original mammalian or reptilian part of my brain, where survival was the only thing that mattered. And the drive of will that came from that pushed me through my terror, because it's dark, it's well below freezing. We have hypothermia. I've got frostbite all over me. I still have my digits, but everything is damaged. All of my extremities, everything on me is damaged. And when you put, I have my electric blanket on now. Okay. I'm sitting here with an electric blanket as we speak.
I'd known I'd send some mittens towards you.
Well, I
have extra set.
I've got fingerless gloves. Look at this. These are what I write with every day. They're motorcycle gloves. I love them, but they keep my hands warm. It's like my fifth pair. It's I use them until I wear them out. And anyway, so hyperthermia is a way of slowly dying over a period of time that where your body cools to death. And so by the time we reached the final rappel, after a night of terror and errors and mistakes and increasing the death came closer with every step. We knew we were going to die. We knew we were going to die. We knew our situation was dire and that the only chance we had was to try to fight our way off in the dark. But with every single step, we're on these cliffs and, you know, we're not harnessed into anything and it's dark and we're feeling our way along. It's not completely dark. We can sort of see, but it's 500, 600 feet up. We finally reach this last rappel and this is where I die. And I'm clipped into the mountain on a harness. I'm on a harness. Harness is on me. And there's a strap that clips into the mountain. It's a teaching spot. It's 100, 150 feet up. It's where people begin. So it's the last rappel and it's straight down. But the rappel that we came down was around the corner, and up around the corner, the rope got stuck and I couldn't get it free. And hypothermia advanced. And I went through the stages of my body getting hot. I should explain that freezing to death, my eyeballs felt frozen. My brain was frozen. My reasoning was slow. I made poor decisions. I unzipped my coat when my body got hot, although I knew intellectually that this is a stage of hypothermia and the last thing I should do is release this heat. But I started to sweat, and so I did. And I remember thinking, I don't really need my hands. I can live without my feet, as the blood rushed to the core of my being. And it was like, I thought this to myself calmly. Oh, I don't need my hands. It'll be okay. And then I had this peace come over me because I realized that I wasn't getting out of here. This was the end game for me. And I started thinking about my parents and my life and God. And then I started to fall asleep, and falling asleep was a snap of the fingers. It was just a blackout. I'd collapse. I'd smack the rock. I'd stand back up, repeat this process. And this last time I stood up, I got tunnel vision, like a spotlight on a stage going to black. Yeah. And went out, and when it went out, I watched it. I watched this thing, and I'm like, "What is this thing?" And I thought, "Am I falling asleep?" But it's not like the other sleeps, and all these thoughts are running through my head. And it goes out, and I don't fall asleep. I'm awake still. I watch it go out, and as it goes out, I wait for myself to collapse, but I don't feel my body anymore. I don't feel anything anymore. In front of me, or what would have been the front of me, an expanse opened up that was an infinite darkness that extended 100 billion light years. And way far in the far, far distance was a pinprick of light, like a single star. And this single star, this single pinprick of light, the size of a pinprick came, but it was really highly illuminative. And it came rushing toward me across this incredible expanse and communicated to me directly. Light, intelligence, like great intelligence and authority and mightiness. And it communicated to me telepathically all those things as it told me, I'm taking you, you're coming with me. And I put up all of my resistance, all of this survival thing, this reptilian thing. I took all this like, no, I'm staying here. And reached right into me and plucked me out. And now I'm inside of it. And inside of it, I have two perspectives. I'm outside of it, looking at me inside of it and kind of paralleling it as we go back the way it came. But I'm also inside of it. And it's like a huge jellified energy like a Higgs boson field of where energy and matter are sort of connected a little bit. And the voice is speaking to me I'm in it like in a cloud. Like, so in the cartoons, they're lounging on clouds. I'm sort of lounging inside of this thing, but it's completely surrounding me and it's transparent. And I have no more agency. I have no more capacity for any decision-making at all. And I don't even care. It's speaking inside of me. It's speaking inside of me comfort. It has made me extraordinarily comfortable as it communicated to me its immense intelligence and almighty power. And so I am, and I can see out of what I can see out of the eyes that I have as a sort of a, I don't know whether it's an astral body or a light body. I don't know what to call this. I was severed from my body. I'd had mystical experiences as a child, and I'd been carried out the proverbial silver cord and back in that was the entity of the divine itself. It was a part of the angelic form, but there was no connection here. Severed. And so I am inside of this entity, this intelligence, this love, and I'm being swept back up the way that it came. And so now I'm to the edge of where it had entered into this sort of physicality of a void, and it popped out. I popped out of it, or it expanded into it. It was like both things at once. It was a separate entity of the divine self. But it was also all that there was. And because when I popped out of it, it was like everywhere. I was inside this infinite darkness that was also illuminated because I could see in every direction at once. And it was, but I could see that I couldn't see the beginning of infinity. I could see further than I could ever see, but not the infinity itself. And I was like an orb of consciousness. I was an energy field. I was a being of that. My thinking was my seeing, was my self, was my hearing, because hearing comes into this. I am all these things at one time. They are not separate functions. Mm-hmm. They are unified function, and I can think faster than I'd ever thought before. I had no brain in the way of my processing, and I processed where I was like that. And in an instant, I became aware of my truer, higher, fuller, eternal, natural, original self. And in this original self, there was an immense amount of remembrance of, oh, me. Oh, me now. Oh, this is who I am and always have been. How did I not know this before? I didn't miss my life at all. There was no, I didn't, I was content with what I was, and what I was alone in this infinity, but this infinity was fullness and energy. And I knew that I was enveloped in it. And so even though I was alone in this, I felt contained, supported, safe. And then I tell all of this, is all in metaphor, Scott, as I'm sure you know. You have you studied NDEs. It's all metaphor. And so in timelessness. So stop me. I can keep going. Shall I keep going? You want me to stop?
Well, this is actually a really interesting thing, because not many people have had this black light void experience. It's, relatively rare.
I describe it as, I originally described it as nothing.
As nothing.
Nothing. No thing.
And no. At the same time, the last words you just used were in the fullness of energy.
Yes, but all metaphor. All yes. Of its metaphor. I was no thing. There was no thing there that was a molecule. There was no Higgs boson. There were no quarks. There was no. There was none of that. It's a different level of physics, where thingness doesn't exist.
Max Planck talk about, consciousness is the foundation of the universe. It's not the things. It's not the molecules, the quarks, or up and down, Higgs, whatever. No, it's consciousness. That's the fundamental thing of the universe. And, you're describing that.
And subsequent to that, in my life, panentheism is a word that describes the divine presence inside of all things and above all things. The originator. It's what Max Planck was saying, but in a theological language.
Yep.
And so I...
Pantheism?
Panentheism with an E-N, not pantheism with an E-N.
Not the multiple God thing.
No, panentheism with an E-N in the middle of pan-N-E-N. And it's a word I try to push.
I'll help you push it because I love that word. That's great.
Me too. I'm a word pusher, Scott.
Do you get in trouble with the law with that, or is it?
Before we came on air, we were talking about authority and what NDEers, what rules we follow. I've had trouble skinny dipping. Let's just say that. Anyway, so
too much information.
No. It's okay. It all worked out great. I didn't get the $70,000 fine. She let me go.
Ooh, that's a lot for being nude.
It was pretty serious, it turns out. Okay. Anyway,
so you're in this space.
I'm in this space. I'm in this space.
No thing.
And I am no thing, and I am my true self. And in this fullness that is emptiness, a portal opens. And in my book, I describe it as a door, and I give it dimensionality. But there is no dimensionality here. It's just much, much bigger than me. And now these days, I've been describing it as a waterfall because that's how I experienced it. It was white light as a waterfall, but it was also made up of 10 billion sparkles. Like this, in this place where I died, the skyscape at night, 10 billion stars and galaxies of all these different colors, because there's no light pollution from there to the Arctic Circle. And it's like that. There's colors like you never see before. And so it's pure white light and all these individuated facets of color all at the same time. It's both. And it has a surface to it. I can see the surface of it. I can see it flow. I can see into it. It's translucent. It has depth to it. And I can see through it all at the same time. It's transparent and it leads deeper into the infinity. And I am, and it is a compulsion. A compulsion arises in me for its beauty. Its beauty and its energy just attract me, and I touch it with my being, my not being, and it flows into me. And then all these things happen simultaneously. And I'm going to tell it with hell first and self-identity after, but that's not the way I experienced it. Not chronological. So as it flowed into me, I saw my human self as I had lived. I saw myself and I experienced myself, all the pain that I'd given away in my life from the interior personal perspective as it happened of every single person that I heard in my life in a chronological order. And I was inside of all of them, feeling their chemical, emotional reactions and angers and confusions and hurts from their point of view, simultaneous to experiencing it from my previously human point of view, with all of my reasons and justifications for causing them that pain, and the disproportion between my rationalizations or emotional responses that caused me to, the wounds I had caused me to wound, were disproportionately tiny in comparison to the pain that I actually gave away in each event. And all of that pain that I gave away in each event was mine. It turned out I gave it to myself. And that that's where it lived. And it lived inside of me. And I judged myself guilty for having made choices of causing so much pain. And I wasn't a bad person. I just was a guy who grew up in America doing guy things. Not, you know, we all got in trouble here and there. I got in trouble anyway. And, I'm a troublemaker. What are you going to do? And I turned out okay. Eccentric, but okay. So
thank goodness for that.
Yeah. Well, because of this, this is what really, this is the seminal event of that changed everything about me. I experience all the pain that I gave away. And meanwhile, the voice, and I'm going way too long here, Scott. We're way over.
Keep running. I'm
all right. Okay.
I can't wait for the next bit.
So I have the experience of the divine pouring love into me, love that had always been there, love that had always existed, forgiveness that was always on offer. And I saw the essential broken nature of all of humanity and all of the universe, and the choices that I made, even though I chose to cause this pain, wasn't my fault because of the design, because of the coding of the universe. It was built this way. Everything is broken. I love you as you are. I love you. I've always loved you. I experienced your life with you. There was nothing about you that is unhidden from me, and I have loved you through all of this pain and suffering that you caused. I love this through everything. I love you as the divine being of love that I made. And I saw the origin of myself. I saw myself as a single photon from one of a 10 billion zillion gigaplex photons that were the whole consciousness itself. But I was one separate reduction of it and called into being. I saw myself being called into being. I saw the length, breadth, and depth of my everlasting soul. I saw individual lives. I was living multiple lives at the same time because of timelessness, and none of those lives matched anything near the capacity of the original nature of my being. And all that mattered was that I was light made from light. And that it became the most important point of existence for me, and as I saw its reality. And so I am fully forgiven, and all of this love, which multifaceted, like all these different colors of light on the waterfall, they all are like joy and beauty and adoration and love and hope and understanding and knowledge, and like knowledge, like cosmic knowledge and bliss and paradise and awe and healing and well-being and adoration, and all of these things expand inside of me, and beauty, until I become in a state of union where one more facet would have obliterated me back into the divine self. And I would have ended as a separate entity. And then I was reduced back down and shown that this was my true self. Mm-hmm. And then I was reduced back down to a much smaller size, back with a relationship to my humanity, my recently previous humanity. And I remembered my family. My sister had vanished when I was a kid, run away, broke my family. It's why I was there. It's what I was worried of, taking my parents would lose another child. The child who's estranged is never buried, but always grieved. And yeah. So they were going to really lose me. And I said, my parents, I can't leave them. Do I have to stay? I was being invited into the wellness and oneness of being. Come, it's your time. Come to us. And I said, am I dead? The voice said, yes. I said, but I can't go yet because of this thing with my parents. And in the moment that I said that, I was swept across heaven to the edge of the creation of our universe, where I was sort of part of my beingness was poked outside of heaven, and I could see the universe. I could see all these galaxies. I could see almost to the origin of the beginning of the universe. But before I could see full to the end, my focus was brought way close in to Earth like right into Earth, and I could see all of Earth and every single human being on it, and every single human being in a live time feed. Like I could see everybody at once, and everybody has a golden speck, a golden flake of love and light inside them, and nobody can see it in anybody else. Everybody's covered and separated, covered over with a great depth. All of Earth and separated, everybody's separated by this foam that they can't see through. But I can see it, and I can see it in murderers, and I can see it in newborn babies, and I can see it in CEOs and teachers. I can see it in everybody, and nobody can see it like I can see it. And the voice says to me, in the way that I love you now. And when it said this, I could see my attention was taken to the origin of the universe, and it became this multiplicity of universes going back eon upon eon upon eon, and all of them spilled toward me with this intensity of a singular love, of an eternal nature of love, that in the voice in a panentheistic way said, all of this is made of me, and all of this is made of love. And I am love forever and ever, was, is, and always shall be. And I love you. And all this love poured into me. And as it poured into me, I felt the particularity of my own belovedness. But as I looked at everyone on Earth, I saw that everyone was particularly beloved as I was. And there was no differentiation in the golden fleck inside the origin of everyone's being. And then my parents' faces showed up. And my parents, I saw all of their suffering that they had endured since my sister left when I was 14. And all of their anguish. And then I saw parallel tracks of lives. I saw their life with me. And I saw their life without me. And as I saw these, I had a comparison of additional suffering without me. But I saw at the end of both tracks of life that they were with me in this reality of the divine presence of love. And that because of that, their well-being was always assured. Never was it in question. And their healing and wholeness was going to be the same as mine. And because the length of my life, I was shown the length of my life was the wink of an eye. Like yeah. That fast time is like over. And because of that, the voice said, they'll be here in a moment. You can stay. And I said, but I can see in the time that they're going to live that for them, it's not going to be a moment. For them, it's going to be a lifetime of worse breakage. And I said, I haven't gone into the fullness of your being yet. Do I have to? And the
I voice, love that. Do I have to? That sounds a little whiny there.
Well, do I have to? Because I'm in the presence of immense infinity, like all power there is. Who am I to ask? Really? So I'm like, do I have to go? And I haven't gone yet. Do I have to go? There was defiance in it. Okay. Now that I'm saying this,
there seems to be a theme here.
Yeah. Well, there's definitely, I have that theme. If you tell me that it's impossible for me to try to do that, I will show that I can. And most of the time I succeed. Sometimes I don't, but so anyway, it says to me, it's time for you to come home. They'll be well. I say, I haven't gone all the way. They say, no. I say, if I go back, can I come back here to this divine beingness? And the voice said, yes, you can come back here. And I say, well, then I choose to live my life, meaning I want to go
In the physical,
I want to go back and eliminate suffering for my parents that they will never know that they didn't have. They'll never know that life path.
Right.
And so the voice says, yes, and kicks me out, flicks me out like a little, you know, off your fingertip, a little pebble. And I shoot off and I get denser as I go, and the angelic form is with me. The voice, there's no separation between the angelic being and the voice. They are one thing. And it's with me and it speaks to me and says, choose. And in front of me, there are a million doorways. And in the center of these million doorways is an extraordinarily wide beam of divine light, like a laser shooting into it. And it's illuminated. And then as it gets further to the outer edge of the million, it gets fainter and fainter and fainter. And it says to me, choose. And I know that it wants me to choose the fullness of the light, but I want some self. And so I choose some self. I can't not choose light. I choose a lot of light, but I choose self. And I enter into this doorway in an instant, the choice is made. And I see all these probabilities of my life, of all the lives. I could see all of the lives, but I see the one that I was in. And I see that if I see that I can work my way back to the light, but I'm just kind of like this. As that goes by, because I'm driven right back down to my body and crushed back down like in a compactor and then squished back inside this physical form and awakened to suffering. And my whole body is full of pain. I don't know where I am. I don't know who I am. I don't know what I am. I don't understand what happened to me. I just know that I'm confined and in pain. And as my brain comes online, I come back to life. I hear my partner, Tim, screaming and yelling and crying. And I feel this thing that I'm in shaking and jostling. And I get my eyes open and he's like, you were dead. You were dead. And he's pulling me up and you were dead. If you died, I was going to die. And all this week. So in all of 10 days of backcountry avalanche, we came to an avalanche area. We had some disasters when we were skiing, but and all through this night, Tim never lost his head until I died. And when I died, when I came back, he regained his composure, and the rope came free on the first pull. We'd been stuck we'd been stuck for hours. And maybe I rolled off the cliff. I don't know. I don't know what happened. I don't know how it came loose. All I know is that eventually he got me to understand enough language came back online. So I'm looking at this guy and I'm thinking, what is he? Not who is he, but what is he? What is this place? Where am I? And I finally get the rope pulled and it comes free and we descend. And we self-treat for hypothermia in the tent with a heater. It's an Arctic tent, so it's got a chimney and a vent. He had all the best gear. It was really good. Actually, he supplied a lot of the gear. It's good stuff. And when we heated up enough of our body, we got in the car and used the car to warm ourselves back up. And then it goes. So that's it. And I talked way more than 10 minutes, Scott.
You think?
And I tried to tell it wicked fast.
Oh my gosh. So you're trying to talk about something that is essentially ineffable. And yes. So what's the process to use to come up with the metaphors that help us understand what you went through?
I had a radical change in my life. I was going to be an architect. I had a pencil in my hand as a kid, father's firm, working in construction. I ditched all of that and I went to divinity school. And I didn't go to divinity school to study theology. I went to divinity school to avoid the monastery of a life of contemplation because I found that the only way that I was going to reattach myself to the divine was by going in the interior, but no sex life. That was kind of a deal breaker for me. So I did the next best thing. I went to divinity school and I convinced the dean of students to allow me a 3-year independent study, which was partially funded. They found money in the university to pay for this, where I got to study the history of contemplation and mysticism from 900 to 1600, primarily in the West, and under her tutelage, and wrote my dissertation on it. So I went hunting for language, Scott. That's what I did. I realized I had taken this class and I had read this book, okay, book called Mysticism, an Anthology by a guy named F.C. Happold, a book I still teach, that exposed me to the history of mysticism. And in the history of mysticism, I was an English major, so I understood metaphor and symbol and myth. And I'd encountered the Romantics and the Transcendentalists, who were primarily mystics, William Blake, Henry David Thoreau for two, Emily Dickinson for three. They wrote in a metaphorical language. When I read these people, I discovered that they were speaking metaphor as well. And so that came to realize is that there were language forms inside of religious traditions, because religious traditions all originate with a mystical experience. Somebody has a visitation from God, and then somebody else builds religion around it. And the problem with mysticism is that it abhors organization, which is why near-death experiencers are difficult to control. Because nobody really cares about what the rules are, except for love. And love becomes the dominant morality of a life lived in a mystical relationship with the divine. So I went hunting for language in divinity school. And then the dean, I was going to go off for my doctorate. And she's like, well, you know, you should consider being a minister because you have all this compassion. I'm like, okay, I'll give it a 3-year try. And I did. And I was going to leave, go back to graduate school. But we got pregnant, my wife and I had to have a job. And so I stayed in
cash flow.
Gotta have it. Got a baby. You know, what's what Buddha say? Before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. That's the way it is. And So I explored Christian language. So I fall into a large rubric into which you fall of mystical experience that is historic, that is trans-religious, trans-cultural. All of them have different languages. The Upanishad language is different than the Buddhist language, which is different than the Jewish language, but all of these have roots in mysticism. And there's all these language forms, traditional language forms, that in their root have mystical meaning. And so I went on this lifelong quest. And so when I was a minister in these churches where I served, I continued reading. I read Zen Mind, Zen Culture, Open Mind, Open Heart, Late Medieval Mysticism, The Meditation of Christ, Rilke, Buddha.
Varieties of mystical experiences.
I read all the Nag Hammadi texts. I read all the Dead Sea Scrolls. I read everything that I could, because none of the languages are accurate.
It can't be by the very fact that they're words. They're putting boundaries on concepts that don't have boundaries.
Exactly. And so what this means is, if we can convince everybody of the truth of what you just said, then we can develop a language for the 21st century where when I say Holy Spirit, you don't hear Bible thumping, oppressive, slave holding 18th century preacher. Right?
Yep.
So when I say Shaktipad, you hear Soma, you hear presence of the Holy Spirit. All of these things are language forms that are simply constructs to communicate the ineffable, and all of them are inadequate, but there's one thing, one language that's not inadequate, and that is the language of the interior journey. And in the interior journey, when one creates a capacity, you can dig your way back to God. I've spent my life digging my way back to the divine, to the source, through my interior practices to create a capacity for energy transmission. And it's energy transmission, not with the direction of intentional healing or communication of anything other than the light itself. Because this golden fleck of light inside all of us, that is the divine presence that sees itself. That's the divine presence that's inside of all of us, experiencing the lives as we live them. And we are beloved for who we are at the core of our being. And when that becomes the orientation and the desire of the heart, when the oneness of being, the singleness of self, the return to the divine, then there's all this forgiveness that flows. I can forgive your brokenness, Scott, because I see my own. I can love your light because I love my own. I can, and it eliminates all of these. It eliminates all these divisions, and it doesn't do it through reason or knowledge. It does it through the divine presence itself.
Yeah, it does and, it through experience.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when you say brokenness, is that another word for duality?
Yes, another word for duality. Because when I was dead the first time, and I need to say that it's not just this near-death experience. It's another near-death experience, and it's a whole series of extraordinary mystical experiences that I've had throughout my entire life that inform my understanding. And so, but when I was dead this first time, I saw the unlimited and the unlimited unmanifested. And it was the unlimited unmanifested, which is purity itself. And purity itself, in its divine nature, can't exist anywhere but in itself. There can be no brokenness in it. There can be no limitation in it. It's the one thing. The one thing. There's a rabbinic question: what's the one thing that the unlimited can't experience? Limitedness. And so the limitedness of duality, this broken nature, which could be called Satan as well, with a small s, not an evil being,
yeah,
but a separation, a darkness. We are all in darkness here in comparison to the light. Even those of us who see light, it's still freaking dark here. Okay. So it's still really dark.
It's
really, really dark. And it can be in some people, even though they have the light, everybody's got this light inside them, but some people, and maybe it's genetics or upbringing or who knows what happened. You know, there's some combination of nurture and nature. I don't really know.
And agreement.
An agreement. Well, selfishness. Agreement. You mean like on the other side?
Yeah. So we.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. That too. Right. Yeah, yeah.
We came in with this design, and you know, part of the design was I got blinders on this time around.
You know? Yep. Most people do, but most people see. Here's the thing: half the people. Marjorie Willicott at the last IANS conference, she gave a paper in which she showed research that showed that 48% of those people studied had 3,350 people-ish had visitations from the dead. That's a mystical experience. That's a seeing of the light. 50% of the people. That's a huge number.
So when you came in, there was this big beam of light, and you could have chosen to go right in the middle of this big beam of light, but you didn't. You kind of moved it a little bit to the outside.
It did.
So that you could have that experience with the divine and have the experience of self.
Yes.
So, right? So now that you're here fully in the physical, how much of a connection do you have on the other side all the time, part of the time, only in your
internal
search? How does that work?
I need to say that I was told that I wouldn't live my life. I was kicked out and told, you're not going to live your life, little boy. Off I went. And I made this choice, and it's been the conflict of my life, Scott. And so I chose not the fullness of the light, and I resisted being consumed. It came back inside of me where it never stops. It never shuts off. It's always loud inside of me, always speaking, always present, but it's not always pleasant. Because I wanted some selfness, because part of it was, if I'm going to work for you, I need to be able to be a regular human being. I can't be in la la land all the time. I can't be. I got to make mistakes and have flaws and love physicality. I got to love physicality.
With motorcycle gloves.
Yeah. And I do love physicality. I am still calculated high extreme sport person, I guess. So I'm still doing things that are age inappropriate. Let's say that.
Love that.
Anyway, I had the thing I wanted the most is this Latin phrase, and I know I'm going to slaughter it because I haven't said it in a long time. It's like tremendium mysterium fascinatium, something like that. What it means is that the thing that I desire the most is the thing that I run from. The thing.
Oh.
And so I was in this position. I dove very deeply inside myself because I found no satisfaction in the world. Zero. Nothing but my beloved, nothing. I went through years of depression because I mourned my loss, and I was pissed off too because I wasn't going to live my life. It's like I didn't read the fine print of the contract. And
no, what? They didn't show it to you? No.
Well, no, they did. It's just that I didn't. I'm like, yeah, whatever. put my X there. and so I had to carve my way back in. I knew that the light was there. I couldn't see it here. I could see, okay. I knew that the divine panentheism generates everything there is, which is why I could see it as only illusion.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see it only as fragmentation and instead of unity. And so in my studies, I realized that there were techniques that I could practice, and I had to choose some. Because there's so many techniques, I had to pick the ones I was going to use, and yep. I would practice those for the whole of my life, which I have done. And now it's 40 years later, I am still practicing them. And I found that in these practices that I two things happened. I carved a space inside myself where my centering prayer practice is all about, it's like very Zazen. It's all about the stillness of the mind and the end of thought and the stepping aside. I'm the only one in the way between me and the divine. If I can step aside in a regular practice every day with my breath and my chant, and eventually deeper than that, I can eliminate my false self. And so that's what I've been after. All the years I was in the church, I was God's secret agent, is what I thought in my head. I didn't tell anybody that because secret agents don't tell, right? So, right. I kept the whole thing a secret.
And their shows get canceled after 4 years. So
yeah. They do, especially if they get caught, right? Ooh. Except for James Bond. He seems to get caught and he keeps coming back. But he gets reincarnated. He's like Doctor Who. He comes back in a new form all the time. So anyway, what happened was that with the Kriya Yoga, I combined these two things, which brings me back to language. And so I realized on the very first day that no language I could speak could ever capture the message itself. What could capture the message itself, capital M on that, but the message itself. And so I practiced these two techniques, Kriya Yoga, combined with Hatha Yoga, physical, and it became Ashtanga and Iyengar and all these other things over all the years. But the Kriya Yoga part always stayed. And the centering prayer. So as I stepped myself aside, I tried to energize my soul larger than myself in the effort to give Shaktipat or energy transmission. Because when a person, when the message is direct, when they have a direct experience of the divine inside themselves, it leaves a lodging of mystical knowledge on the interior of the soul that the soul knows forever. And the brain might have to catch up with it. The brain might never grasp it, which it never will grasp it, but it can experience it. And if that can be communicated directly in a group, which is what I experience when I go to the IANS conferences, there's so much divine energy there. You're nodding your head yes, so I'm assuming that you have a similar experience there.
I do, exactly. Yeah.
Among the Trappist monks where I was getting trained and guided, they created the radiance themselves. I experienced it with them the first time that I experienced it. And in a group, and in IANS in a group, there's the capacity of humanity that's inborn in us. If we recognize, if we keep pointing at the light and not ourselves, because this is a technique to step aside. It's a technique to take ego out of it, to see, but more importantly, you're not your human body. You are your divine light. And the more of us that find a way to channel selflessly the divine presence, the more illuminated we all become together, because there's a magnification process. There's like when you walk into that IONS conference, my experience was like walking into a force field of magnification. Like my aura got bigger, like I got inflated and everybody else's was too. And we're all like, whoa. You've put on some lightweight, haven't you? Lightweight.
Yeah, and it's so true. That's when you get into that group of people, or, you know, I've taught meditation for 35 years.
Yes.
And when you're sitting there with a group of people, 30 people, 25, whatever, and you all have the same intent.
Mm-hmm.
That group energy is way more powerful than just the individuals there. It's like you said, there's a multiplier effect, and it builds on each other and it becomes clearer.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the fuzziness that I have is tempered because this person is helping out. And it's one of the reasons I really love it when we can gather together as groups and try to accomplish something, you know, in my classes, at conferences. Yes. It's one of the reasons I like being an MC at IONS. It's because I get to help kind of direct some of that and be able to create the energy around it that you want to have in a conference. And for me, it's about, this is serious work. So you got to be a little silly when you do it. So
you're my mentor. And that's what I'm going to try to do this year while you're away for the year. I want to help. The conference this year is about oneness and illumination. And I want to help create an atmosphere where that can be magnified. You know, one of the things that Jesus said was, where two or three are gathered, I am there. And in the Gospel of Thomas, he expands that. And it is, and when he says, I am, he's not talking about himself. He's talking about this, what Christians, mystics call the Christ consciousness, which other people call the divine energy or the oneness of being or Atman or Brahman or Allah.
Well, the whole time you were describing your experience, that's the word that, you know, the words that kept popping in my head. There's, you know, how do you describe something that's limitless? And the only thing the word was, I am.
I am.
It's everything and nothing. And there's no boundaries and there's no descriptors because it's, there aren't any that make any sense.
Isn't that an imposition on us to give to the one thing that is all there is, to not ever be able to say it? And so it remains sort of secret in all of our hearts. And that's one of the things that has happened, is that mystics, people who have mystical experiences, because they're so individualized and subjective, although they can be group, because we just described that. You can have that in a meditation group. But it is individualized, it's unsayable, and it's repressed. And so is it any wonder that we've kept to ourselves for centuries? Not anymore, though. That's over.
Not anymore. And the lovely thing is that we have, you know, technology now. We have the internet, so that
exactly,
you know, anybody in the world can take my class, they can listen to this podcast, they can take your class. I mean, it's and you can do it from anywhere. I know when I teach online, I happen to use Zoom as the technology, that ability to have group energy is just the same. It's just the same. Well, of course, that makes sense because there is no such thing as time and space. Right. That's just the illusion of duality. So have you found that the rules of the non-physical universe, you have been able to pull them back into the physical universe and make sense of this life, help other people figure out what they're about?
Yes, and yes, but I don't know if I've made knowledge sense of them. They remain insensible to me, but there's a level of practicality to them that I've nurtured over the whole of my career. Some of the way that it's manifested has been in helping the poorest of the poor, and the hungry and the needy and the wounded and the ailing and the dying. And so in my clergy life, my focus was on the brokenness of human experience in its most dire ways, in the context of the communities where I've lived. And that's one way of trying to, I could never fix the brokenness of all there is, but I could maybe relieve some suffering for those who were desperate. And so there was that, but I find that the deeper that I dive inside myself, and this is probably the biggest thing in my life, for what you ask, the greater the capacity I have grown inside myself, the larger the overflow becomes. And so I live in the world in a bubble of light. It doesn't eliminate my problems. It doesn't fix my back, or, you know, stop me from stubbing my toe, or you know, prevent me from missing a credit card payment and making my credit thing go up, you know?
Right.
Right. You know, all those things remain real. But I live inside this. I live. And so my world becomes more magical, and it allows me to see more clearly the woundedness of others and let them be themselves, forgive them for who they are. And because most people have no idea, they're wearing the blinders that they agreed to, and they don't know. It's like being, I feel like sometimes I'm in the Matrix and I'm, I can't even think of Keanu Reeves. I can't think of his character's name. I'm like, I see the code. Nobody else see the code, so I can do what I can to help people who can't see the code. And so that's how I live my life. I help where I can. But in terms of, I live disassociated from time. I live non-attached. I know my other self, my higher self is my true self. So I live sort of as a witness here, which gives me a courageousness in my career. That has had, well, I just leave it at that. They gave me courageousness in my career, and it gives me connectedness to nature. It gives me connectedness to humanity. It helps me see my own flaws. I haven't chosen to try to become a medium or a healer. I've chosen to pursue the oneness of being, because I'm not from here. And the deeper, it's not about this lifetime for me. It's about my eternal connection to divine love. And so I think that orientation itself has created a life for me that's, it's unusual. I've lived a very unusual life, but it's, people where I live, let me put it this way, people where I live, and I live in a small town, and I've lived here for 25 years. I was the minister in this town before I went into television. People accept me for who I am. They know I'm eccentric, but they also, and they're like, oh, he's the stilt walker with the clown nose, kind of thing.
That word right there, by being defined as eccentric, gives you this huge latitude for behavior.
Oh, it totally does.
you can do all kinds of things, and they go, "Oh, that's just Peter. He's just, that's Peter doing Peter." You know, yes. And it, And if you accepted more of a socially appropriate role, they go, well, no, I'm sorry, but this guy's weird, or we have to put him in the psych ward. But no, that's just...
Oh, well, they came close to that one time.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yep. Well, I had a mystical experience when I was in divinity school that lasted 3 days, and that I knew what was going on because I'd just been studying mysticism for 3 years. And I also knew who I was, but the exterior presentation of mystical experiences can sometimes be mistaken for crazy. And that's a hazard for everybody. And that's why people don't talk about it, because you don't want to be appeared as crazy.
Yeah.
So
interesting you should say that, because I just had a friend of mine who I've known for 20 years who recently had a spiritually transformative experience, and his wife put him in the psychiatric evaluation.
And
he kept saying, all I'm trying to do is to learn how to love in this world. Yep. And it's not what I thought it was before. It's different. And I'm trying to tell you why it is different. And anyway, and of course, because of the radical shift in personality, they said, whoops, this isn't who you were. And we're concerned about you, seriously concerned.
And you put your finger on it there. Mystical experiences give us new identities.
Mm-hmm. They have to. Part of my PhD work was in leadership at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. There, if you haven't heard of it, it's Minnesota's largest private university. And, one of the things I came to understand was that leadership is an inside-out phenomenon. What you believe about how the world works, or how the universe works, or who you are, what is this thing that is us? That's what is presented out into the world. And, a spiritual experience changes that internal dynamic. So, of course, you're going to present yourself differently. That's, if you're being authentic, you have to present differently. And if you try to assume your old role, everybody's antenna is so good that they can go, oh, there's something odd about Peter, because he's not being authentic. He's not being his true self, even though it looks like the same. Something's wrong.
I wore a mask the whole time I was in the church. I wore a mask but it leaked out all over the place. So I lived my authentic life inside myself. That's, I continued my studies, I continued my practices, but I misled the church to think that I was a believer.
And it takes a while to learn acceptable language.
Yeah.
You have this experience and all of a sudden you're trying to wrap words around it to tell people it. And sometimes you choose language that makes you sound crazy.
Yep.
And finding acceptable language is part of the path of being here in duality now that you've chosen to come back.
And finding people where you can speak freely, where there haven't been groups. So after I left TV, the show closed after 15 years for me, 91 years for the whole show. I toured New England as a preacher, as a near-death experience preacher, like everybody, I was out of the closet, everybody knew. And so all these little churches would invite me to come speak. And I surveyed in all these churches. And the survey I took was, who here has ever had a visitation from the dead? And nobody would raise their hand until I did. And then half the congregation and every congregation would raise their hand. Who here has ever told anybody? Everybody told somebody, but nobody told the church. Nobody would talk about it in public. They wouldn't mention it at the cocktail party. They wouldn't bring it up to their buddies. They would keep it secret. And because nobody wants to be seen as crazy. So there's this open secret.
Yeah, the last stat I saw was 45%. What's your percentage?
I thought it was 48 that she said, but maybe it was 45. I saw 50 to 70% in these congregations, not just after death experience, not just after death communication, but in up to 70%, including near death experience, visitations from Jesus, angels, all the various phenomenon placed to 50 to 70% every time.
I wonder how much it would be if they included things like events or signals from nature, you know, like mom's favorite bird sitting on the windowsill pecking at it the whole time.
Yep, that kind of thing. This buddy of mine, he finds dimes, and whenever he finds dimes, he feels his son be present. And it's a great practice for him. He's always looking for his son wherever he goes. He's always carrying his son in his pocket.
Nice. I like that. So this energy transmission that you were talking about, you give Shaktipak. So there's the, you know, kind of the ceremonial thing around that. But how else do you see yourself giving energy out to people?
That's the most important way for me. It's been a long experiment. I kept that part of my life secret for 40 years as well, until people told me that they could feel it from me. And I'd never asked. I never brought it up, never mentioned it. Didn't want to. It's like if you're in a counseling session and you could say to someone, what color do you think that was? And they'll say some color. But if you say, what color blue do you think that was? You're influencing their choice. And I didn't want to influence anybody's telling me. So it's the most important thing. But I have not church. I do on Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. Live stream on YouTube. I do biblical deconstruction, primarily right now in the Gospel of Thomas, because Jesus talks like a near-death experiencer to me. That's what he sounds like to me. And so I'm fighting the mistaken idea that he was the only son of God, and that his real message was that we are all seekers and we're all made of light and we're all children of God. That they were all the same as him, and
we all got that gold speck in us.
Yeah. We all got that gold speck in us, and so I'm doing that. What I'm trying to do is get help people who've left the. Primarily left, but not exclusively, because I have a lot of Buddhists and other kinds of people who watch my videos. But I try to help former Christians use the language that they're used to rethink their relationship and to see what Jesus was always talking out of the first person. He's teaching in the second person, woe be unto you, but he's really talking about his own experience. And he's a mystic. He had an awakening, an enlightenment, and the stories that he tells, for the most part, aren't the theologies that developed into the dogmas that the church teaches. And so that's a big part of what I do. I teach meditation 3 days a week, live on YouTube. I teach some Kriya Yoga. Mm-hmm. Over my career, I've done a lot more. Like, I sat on the domestic violence homicide review panel for the state of Maine for 7 years. Ish, reading case files of murders and helping on a social level frame legislation that would aid those who are in domestic violence situations. So it came out in a lot of different organizational ways, interpersonal ways, so linguistic ways, presentational ways. It's always about the one thing for me, though. All these ways that it manifests are all secondary avenues of expression. And I try to stoke the fire inside me so that then those creative things can become practical and reality-based for people who are in need, whatever they are. I wrote the books for it. That's the reason I wrote my... Heaven is Beautiful, because I wanted other near-death experiencers to feel free to have a voice. You know, I'm stepping out here you can step out with me. You know, 15 million of us can step out together. 100 million of us can step out together. And then we become a voice, a nudge. We can nudge society. All of the mystical experiencers who are love-oriented can nudge society, especially if cataclysm comes. If cataclysm comes, that's when change happens structurally and organizationally in families, in societies, and in nations, in corporations as well. A catastrophe is ripe with opportunity for change. And if we can, in this period of time in human history, where we have this technology and we're all kind of stepping out now, continue our communication and see what develops, and this radiance that's a multiplier, we're a pretty big force of divine light. And I know that people have been talking about the Great Awakening forever and ever and ever. St. Paul was talking about it. Every generation, the Millerites in Maine, they were talking about it. The Muslims, they've got their own end times. The fundamentalist Christians are like, let's get Israel back in play so that we can have Armageddon. Let's get Armageddon here. Everybody's talking about the great change. But I really think that as medical science driving technology, raising the dead all over the world, That is really the driver of spirituality on a global scale now.
Oh, that is. Just think of all of us who've had some sort of mystical experience. And there's so many of us.
So many of us.
That, you know, we could start affecting change in a way that would be profound for the human condition. I'll go to that church.
Exactly. And mysticism abhors organization. So the last thing we should do is organize a religion. But we can organize, we can have, like, I run Not Church. I call it Not Church for a reason, because it's not church. I don't want it to become a religion. I don't want it to become a church. I don't want it. It's like, it's your divine direct experience. It's all about you, baby. It's all about your relationship.
Yep. Love it. So how do people find you, Peter? Where can they get a hold of your books and your classes and your podcasts and all that? Give us a good commercial, will you?
Well, I'd be happy to. PeterPanagor.love, PeterPanagor.love. All of my links are there. My books are available all over the world in multiple of formats on every continent. And it's an Amazon, an Audible bestseller, my second book. And I do counseling services for spiritually transformative experiences, mystical experiences, near-death experiences. I do consulting, counseling, and spiritual conversation is my latest way of putting it. I'm on YouTube. I've got a channel, and look me up, hit me up. I'm very communicative.
Terrific. Thank you, Peter. This has been a wild and wonderful conversation. I so look forward to continuing this again as we progress down the path a little bit. This is going to be fun. And best wishes as being the co-MC of the IANS International Conference in Salt Lake City this year. So, yahoo!
Thanks. Thanks. Your blessing helps.
You're going to have a great time, as will all of the attendees. So, thanks everybody for watching. Stick around a little bit. I've got a couple of comments that I want to tag on to the end of this. So, we'll see you in a second.
This is one of the most articulate descriptions of a blacklight NDE I have ever come across. I've listened to this interview a couple of times just to savor his word choices. I hope you do the same. That led me to some insights. Just to be clear, these are my viewpoints, but that's why you watch the Afterlife File, to gain perspective by using more than one lens with which to view this rich information. Some of it could use expansion. So let's do that. First off, filter. The idea that our brain acts as a filter to let in only the most necessary information from all the information that's available to us in the universe. This was particularly evident when he said, and I'm quoting, "My thinking was my seeing, was myself, was my hearing. I am all these things at one time. They are not separate functions. I can think faster than I've ever thought before. No brain is in the way of my processing," end quote. Not only is the brain a filter, note how he says it inhibits thought, that the brain is not required for processing consciousness. Isn't that great? Okay, number two, negotiations. Here, anything seems possible. When Peter was shown the multiple timelines of his parents with and without his presence, he had a choice. Reminder, he could also choose how much connection to the divine he wanted in his return life. Point number three. I was impressed with the divine intervention as the stuck rope that caused his death was released immediately upon coming back to the physical so both he and his climbing partner could rappel off the mountain to start the job of recovering their wounded bodies. Okay, fourth, coding of the universe. Peter used the term broken to describe the operation of the non-physical universe. That term has religious overtones to me. I'm not sure that the world of duality, coded for contrast, is broken, think bad, if it's designed to give us a particular type of experience apart from the unity experience that we all came from. And just to remind us all, we signed up for this trip into duality, by the way. And fifth, we are created in the image of God. His metaphor was a golden flake embedded in us, covered up with humanity's physical foam. He was clear, we all have that spark of divinity in us. We all have that golden flake. No exceptions. I hope that videos such as this can give you some insight on what near-death and shared-death experiencers discover about the afterlife, the nature of consciousness, and how to live your life more fully. In addition, I have 6 albums that you can use to start your exploration on your own. If you're ready to jump all in, the best way to experience the other side is to participate in our 5.5-day retreat. This retreat has 2 trainers, 25 exercises into the non-physical universe, and the distinct advantage of supportive group energy and intention. I would encourage you to go down below and look at the links associated with the NDE retreat. These links will take you to the information on the different elements of the course and the skill set that you'll learn. This course uses binaural beat technology so that you can attain and sustain expanded states of consciousness easily and safely. That means this course is perfect for both adept meditators and newbies. Everyone will benefit. All right. Part one of this interview was about the details of Reverend Panagore's blacklight experience and what he came to understand about the nature of the universe and what it means to be human. Be sure to listen to part two of this interview where the two of us get a chance to have a conversation about what it's like to return to the physical with everything changed. If you're watching on YouTube, please like, subscribe, and comment. You can find the Afterlife Files on all podcast streaming apps, Apple, Google, Spotify, Audible, the lot. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, or pay us a visit at our website, neardeathmeditations.com. I'll repeat that. NearDeathMeditations.com. Bye now. See you next time, and thanks for joining us.